This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Early in the new book, Man Seeks God, the author writes, "Romantic and divine courtship have much in common. Both demand courage, a high tolerance for disappointment, and an unflagging faith in the power of dumb luck. This is where flirtation comes into play. Flirtation is a safe way of taking a potential relationship for a test drive." Thus, perhaps, explaining the book's full title, Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. If you know anything about the author, you'd expect humor and self-deprecation, but this new book is also filled with serious and moving revelations about the human search for meaning. So whatever your feelings on religion, if you've ever had a single thought about God, or wondered what other people around the world think on that subject, your invitation to speak with author Eric Weiner will be coming up right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The book is titled Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Its author is former NPR correspondent Eric Weiner, and he is speaking to us today from a borrowed NPR studio in Washington, D.C. Eric Weiner, thanks so much for making time for us.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Happy to be here.
What do you think somebody is going to get out of reading this book?
That's a tough question. I suspect no two people will get exactly the same thing out of it. What I'm hoping that they'll get out of it is a slightly altered view of religion and God, perhaps something a bit different than what they came to the book with, a slightly shifted perception in terms of what this religion thing is all about, what God is all about, whether that person reading it was a sort of, you know, diehard atheist or a, you know, true believer in one religion or another. I'm hoping they're able to get that out of it. And in addition, just have a good time, because I tried to make the book fun, and fun and religion are two words that don't normally go together. I think that's a shame.
I wanted to ask you, did you mean to write this book with so much humor in it? Or is that just your personality?
Well, I can't really help it. That just sort of comes out. And it struck me, you know, basically, they say you write the book that you want to read. And as far as I was concerned, there was no book out there about religion that really spoke to me. They were either quite anti-religious, books by the angry atheists, I call them, that make very compelling cases that appeal to my rational side a lot, but left me feeling empty, ultimately. Or, on the other hand, they're books that just assume a belief in a God, in one God, and have no room for doubt or for fun. And I thought, why not write a book that was completely honest about my spiritual search? I know that's a cliched term, but there it is. A book that's honest and that's fun. You know, the British writer G.K. Chesterton once said, "The test of a good religion is whether one can make fun of it." And I think that's true. Nowhere is it written in the Old Testament, New Testament, or the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu holy book, that, you know, religion must be very serious and no fun at all.
So let's travel back a bit in time, back to what I think is late summer of 2007. You end up in a hospital emergency room.
Right. And I don't like hospitals. I mean, even less than most people. My father was a doctor, and I was convinced, you know, because he would take me along for the rounds at, I was 8 or 9 years old, to various hospitals. And he was an oncologist. And a lot of his patients died, and they tended to die in hospitals. So as an 8-year-old, I was convinced that if I only avoided hospitals, I would never die. And I'm not really kidding. This was really what I internalized. So just to give you an idea that I really have this visceral fear of hospitals more than most people, I think.
But you're, yes, in agonizing pain.
Right, I am.
5 years ago.
And, yes.
And you have to, despite your feeling about going to a hospital might mean risking death, because that's
right,
what happens in hospitals, you have to go. And you're there in an emergency room for a long time, and nobody seems to be able to figure out what's causing the pain, what's wrong with you. Doctors are looking at you with worrying expressions. So this is not making you feel all that much more comfortable. And at some point, a nurse leans over and whispers in your ear.
She does. She was there to draw blood, and she must have picked up on my fear. And the words that she whispered were, "Have you found your God yet?" She said it somewhat matter-of-factly, not in a sort of malevolent way, in a somewhat kindly way, but there were the words. And that really freaked me out, Tom, I have to say, because now I'm already, my mind is spinning that I've got something awful that they can't even diagnose. And now this nurse perhaps has seen my, CT scan and my chart, and she, knows I'm going to be meeting my maker soon. That really sent me into a full-fledged panic at the time.
You eventually do recover.
Right. This is a bit embarrassing, but after 3 days of tests and at great expense to, some insurance company somewhere, and I guess the whole healthcare system, they determined that I was suffering from a severe and prolonged case of intestinal gas. This is a true story.
That went away, the pain went away, but the question stayed with you. And it was sometime not too long after, I understand, that your daughter, Sonia, who's 5 years old at the time, that the two of you are on a tandem bicycle?
Yes, we're riding on this bike trail that sort of skirts along at one point Reagan National Airport.
So let me read a little bit from the beginning of your book, just after the hospital session. Dad, she said, not long after my hospital stay, we were riding one of those tag-along bicycles. I was in the front pedaling and steering, and she was in the back pedaling, always pedaling. Yes, Sonia, I was expecting another but question. She entered the butt age and had many questions about that particular body part. But as she often does, my daughter surprised me. Quote, "Is God responsible for us?" I nearly swerved into oncoming traffic. Then what happened?
Well, then I basically had a moment where a minor epiphany came to me, and it was in the nick of time because, children are very demanding about the truth, and they can see right through counterfeit answers. And so I basically said to her, I said, yes, God gave us everything we need to be responsible for ourselves, which strikes me as true, and she seems satisfied with it. But she asked further questions. I mean, children really force our hands spiritually. I think, even if we've drifted away from whatever faith we were brought up with or whatever spiritual tenets we held on to, when you have a child, particularly a child of that age, 4, 5, 6, you're going to get the God questions, and you have to be prepared to answer them.
So we're leading up to something here, and to get there, I want to ask you if you could turn to page 9 of your book there in the NPR studio in D.C., and read to us from the section that starts with the words, "a few days later."
Right. "A few days later, when I was putting her to bed, she announced that she saw God." "You did?" "Yes. He was in the sky like a big cloud," she said, holding her fist above her head in order to demonstrate. "Well, how did you know it was God and not just another cloud?" "I could tell." "Well, what did you do?" "I waved and said, 'Hi, God,' she said, as if it were the obvious thing to do, and I was slow. I am slow." The ER nurse had laid down the gauntlet, asking me a question that demanded a serious answer and not, as is my wont, a clever rejoinder, a joke. At the time, there was an urgency to her question, "Have you found your God yet?" as I lay in that cold examination room thinking I was dying. Is it any less urgent now? The fact is, I am dying. We all are, though not quite as quickly as I feared. The nurse, wittingly or not, issued a call in the old mythological sense of the word, and I feel compelled to respond, lest I end up like one of T.S. Eliot's hollow men, those wretched, pitiful souls who hear a call but refuse to heed it. The 17th-century French philosopher Blaise Pascal coined the term God-shaped hole to describe that yawning void that is the human condition. I quite like the term, Every time I hear it, I think of donuts and of my life. Over the years, I've attempted to fill my God-shaped hole with all manner of stuff. Food, sex, bags, success, more food, travel, drugs, books, more food, leather-bound notebooks, red Zinfandels, Cuban cigars, yet more food, pretentious foreign films, and once, briefly and ill-advisedly, a concoction of Guinness and Jack Daniels imbibed through a plastic funnel. None of this has worked. Why not try filling my God-shaped hole with God?
Eric Weiner, author of the new book, Man Seeks God, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Eric, this set of circumstances sets you on a journey, starting with the nurse's question while you're wondering if you're dying in a hospital emergency room, and then your daughter underscoring it a few days later. You decide that you're going to explore religions around the world, and we should point out that you grew up in a family that had a religion, although it didn't practice it very intensely. You called yourself, a gastronomical Jew?
A gastronomical Jew, yes. For us, it was all about the bagels and lox and gefilte fish and white fish salad. And if we could, you know, eat it, then it was Jewish and had something to do with God, maybe. We didn't really talk about God. And although I went through some very minimal motions of Judaism, you know, attending synagogue once or twice a year, that sort of thing, we were, you know, largely secularized. And I think this is true not only of many Jewish people in this country, but many Christians and perhaps Muslims as well, is that, you know, faith for us has become this sort of empty ritual. You know, it's something where you go through the motions. There's no heart or no soul left in it. I believe Abraham Heschel, a Jewish theologian, once said our prayers are stillborn. And I think that's a good way of putting it.
Eric Weiner, you don't use the exact words that I'm about to say in your book, but I got a real sense that in the circles in which you've traveled, at least for the past 10, 15 years or more as an adult, that talk about God and talk about religion is sort of embarrassing, is the kind of thing that it might be reasonable to suppose that many of the people that you interact with on a daily basis are polite agnostics, or if they're not, they hide their religion well.
I think that's absolutely true. It's not sort of embarrassing. It actually is embarrassing. I think there's an assumption if you're, you know, traveling in, you know, sort of quote-unquote intellectual circles, you know, New York, Washington, Boston, L.A., I imagine, to some extent, that, you know, you don't talk seriously about God. You only talk about it in religion, really, in a mocking way. There's an assumption, just like there's probably an assumption that you fall on the liberal side of the political spectrum, there's an assumption that you're either an agnostic, as you say, or perhaps an atheist, but that you don't take religion very seriously and that you don't take religious people very seriously, that somehow they are not quite as bright. You know, Tom, there's one statistic that was also sort of the intellectual impetus for my book, and that is this. People who are religious, as defined by people who attend religious services regularly, are happier than people who aren't. And this is consistent over 40 years of studies looking into this. And my friends in the so-called Acela corridor here in Washington and New York, they poo-poo that result. They assume that, as one person quipped, ignorance is bliss, or they think there's something wrong with the study. But the fact is, people who are religious are happier. And now, why is the question? Is it because of some transcendent connection to the divine? Or is it simply because religious people tend to belong to groups like churches and synagogues? And we know that that group mentality makes us happier. It's an open question.
And yet many of the people that you hang out with, it appears in the book, would jump to the conclusion that those people maybe are happier because they're not smart enough to be unhappy, that they don't know enough about the state of the world. So,
absolutely.
Noting that, you are kind of going against the grain of the culture you hang out in to explore very seriously the question of God and how one finds God. And we're going to continue this journey with you in 1 minute. have any thoughts on God? Have any thoughts on religion? Have you yourself ever investigated what other religions might be like and whether there's one that might be better for you than the one you were exposed to as a child? Or do you just have a question about the process of how one goes about looking into such things? Our guest is former NPR correspondent Eric Weiner. We're talking about his newest book, Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. If you want to talk to him, we do have our phone lines open now at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that translates to 888-967-2825. So pretty early in your book, Eric, you establish that there are at least 1,000, if not thousands, of religions in the world today.
Yeah, and more than nearly 10,000, actually. It's quite remarkable.
You have to narrow it down some in order to do some sort of investigation of what works for which people and whether any of these might work for you. How do you narrow it down? You end up with eight.
Right. Well, right off the bat, I could sort of, through a process of elimination, I could eliminate religions that did not accept converts. And there are some out there, such as the Zoroastrians, a very ancient religion originally from Iran. Fascinating, but they don't accept converts. Some religions struck me as overly narrow, such as Hungarian folk religion. Being neither Hungarian nor particularly folksy, I eliminated that one. And then really I went for ones that A, appealed to me. By that, I mean they seem to offer an approach to life that somehow, in some intuitive sense, I knew that I was lacking. For instance, I grew up in a Jewish, nominally Jewish household, where if we studied Judaism, it was very much in a scholastic, academic way. And I felt that if I was going to explore Judaism as I do, it would have to be something more heart-based, and I discovered Kabbalah offered that. And I wanted a cross-section of religion. So there's some of them I chose are monotheistic, like Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, and some are polytheistic, like Wicca or neo-paganism, as it's sometimes called. And some are non-theistic or even atheistic religions, and there are such a thing. Buddhism and Taoism do not believe in a creator God the way monotheistic religions do, yet they are, by any definition, I think, really a religion. And so they were in there as well. I did try to eliminate cults. And the way I defined cults was not by the oddness. If you could see me in the studio, you would see me doing the little quote air quotes around oddness, because who is to say whether a religion is odd or not, right? It's one man's crazy is another man's liturgy and vice versa. But rather, I eliminated cults which I considered coercive. And so somehow I came up with this list of eight, and looking at it struck me as a pretty good list. Not perfect, perhaps, but a good cross-section of different ways to answer that nurse's question.
And you start with a somewhat mysterious aspect of Islam?
Yes, the Sufis. Now, had you heard of the Sufis before?
I had, yes.
Yeah.
But only because I'd lived in places of the country where they would stand out on highways or country roads waving to people. They were immigrants. And I found them to be a very friendly, very engaging group. So I learned a little bit about them, but I wouldn't be surprised if many readers who pick up this book will not have heard of them.
Well, again, so I didn't want to skirt Islam. You know, it's the 800-pound god in the room. Everyone has an opinion about Islam, whether we voice it or not. But which aspect of Islam? The more austere I would say sects such as Wahhabi Islam did not appeal to me. But from what I knew of the Sufis, I knew about Rumi, who was a 13th century Persian poet who actually spent most of his life living in Turkey, wrote some amazingly evocative, passionate, beautiful poetry, and is still quite popular today. I knew that he was a Sufi. And I knew about the whirling dervishes, somewhat tangentially, but the dervishes are Sufis as well. So here was an emanation of Islam that, to my mind, seemed to be completely the opposite of the Islam that I had been exposed to either in reading or in my travels as a foreign correspondent for National Public Radio. Here was an Islam of the heart, and an Islam that seemed very approachable, even perhaps for an outsider like myself.
But you start in California.
Right. And in retrospect, that may have been something of a misstep on my part. But it just struck me that, you know, all great spiritual journeys begin somewhere in California. and I had stumbled across this advertisement on the web, I believe, for Sufi camp. And I thought, wow, Sufi camp. And there was a online brochure, and it showed a sort of these sort of big chunky goblets, wine goblets, and it said, "Sufi camp, come drink with the beloved." Now, the Sufis are known as the drunkards of Islam. But by that, as I would learn, they don't mean like Zinfandel or a rosé. They mean drunk with the love of Allah, of God.
But some, you know, Sufis, at least, unlike most of Islam, allow alcohol? Or just California Sufis?
Yeah. There are some 50 or so different orders, or tariqas, as they're called, of Sufism, and they vary widely. There was an Indian man who brought Sufism to this country in the early 20th century, and his progeny are basically the one Sufi order in the East Coast and one on the West Coast. I was attending the one on the West Coast. And they do not even, many of them do not convert to Islam. They believe that you can be a Sufi without being a Muslim. And that is considered problematic by Muslim Sufis elsewhere in the world. So it is a very Americanized version of Sufism. And while I did enjoy my time at Sufi camp, I think on day five had something of a breakdown where I just couldn't take the hodgepodge nature of it. And I suppose this is a subtle dig at the so-called New Age movement. I'm all for experimentation. That's what I did myself in my book. But if you're throwing everything together in one big melange, then are you really anything? And so we would begin each day with some Japanese tea ceremonies, recitation of Buddhist sutras. I had a very nice Jewish Sabbath at Sufi camp, and there was some Sufism in there as well, don't get me wrong. But it seemed like
you got to the point where you felt if you really wanted to know about this aspect of Islam, you needed to travel place different
in the
world.
Yeah, I needed to go to the source.
You went to Turkey?
Right. And Turkey is the home of Rumi, was the home of Rumi and of the whirling dervishes. And Sufism is still somewhat underground there. Atatürk, the founder of the modern state of Turkey, was a hardcore secularist, to put it mildly, and he banned all the Sufi orders when he came to power. But it is allowed somewhat now. It is somewhat of a tourist attraction, the dervishes, but there is also a genuine Sufism that's practiced there. And I was quite pleased with my decision to go to Turkey. I had an amazing time there.
And from Turkey, you travel to Konya. Is that in Turkey?
That's in Turkey, right in the middle of the country, smack in the middle.
And it's where many pilgrims of Sufism go at one point or another?
Of Rumi in particular.
Okay.
They go to see the Rumi shrine and to recite his poetry. And to hold what's called zikr. Zikr means literally remembrance, and it's a recitation of some of the 99 names of God, of Allah. And the Sufis are very musical. There's lots of music. There's lots of chanting.
So Eric Weiner, yeah, author of this new book, Man Seeks God, with that copy that you have in front of you in the studio you're in Washington, D.C., if I could get you to turn to page 39.
Okay.
And if you would start reading from about the middle of the page, the paragraph begins with the words, "One of our traveling companions," And I'll just let you select where to stop. And then I want to ask you about it.
Very well. One of our traveling companions is Dilek's friend, Baron. I should say Dilek was my guide during this whole trip to Turkey. She is happy, quite possibly the happiest person I have ever met. Baron warns me that during our stay in Konya, an auspicious time that coincides with Rumi's death anniversary, people, women and men, might suddenly cry for no apparent reason. Sometimes it's so intense, it's almost unbearable, she says. She suggests I don't fight the tears. Sufis consider crying a means of cleansing the heart, and for Sufis there is nothing more important than a clean heart. As our taxi traverses Konya's treeless streets, Baron throws out this bit of Sufi folklore. If your tears are salty, your heart is not clean enough. If your tears are bitter, your heart is not clean enough. If your tears are sweet, then your heart is clean. What if your tears won't come at all? I wonder slightly. I could use a good cry. Salty, sweet, barbecue flavored, whatever. My tears are calcified, backed up. Depression, contrary to what we normally believe, is not sadness, but an inability to fully feel sadness. Depression is sorrow denied.
And let me stop you there,
yeah, please.
Because that leads to something we haven't talked about. It's not clear from your book, Eric Weiner, when this began, but it becomes clear pretty early in your journey that you're dealing with some fairly serious depression throughout the time that you're on this worldwide journey.
And before, actually, yes. I suffered from, I would say, I guess, mild to moderate depression probably throughout my life, and have tried various therapies over the years. But I never really considered it a, what's the term used sometimes, spiritual emergency. Yet there is a whole school of belief that essentially sometimes, not always, but sometimes what we perceive as depression or perhaps anxiety is actually a sign that we're not living our lives the way we should be, or that we are not spiritually attuned the way we should be. And there's a long tradition of this that, you know, basically our mind is sending a warning that not only might there be a chemical imbalance, but there's a spiritual imbalance as well.
Is it accurate to say, Eric, that as you're proceeding in this journey, you begin to operate on the notion that if I find a religious experience that results in my depression lifting, then I've found the right way to God?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if I fully articulated it that way, but I'll say this. I was not interested in religious ritual for its own sake. I was not interested in religion as sort of an explanation for the cosmos. I believe that's probably best left to science. But I was interested in religion as a kind of what I call applied philosophy. And I suppose another word for that is wisdom. You know, there's a quote from the psychologist and scholar William James, who lived about 100 years ago. He was very much a pragmatist. In fact, he founded a school of philosophy called pragmatism. And he once said, truth is what works. Truth is what works. And I find that a compelling statement, and to be actually a true statement, because it works for me. It's the idea that, you know, if you look at religious people and their practices and their happiness or lack of depression, whatever, I think it's wrongheaded to ask, is that religion true or not? Does it work is a better question. Does it make its followers happier, quote unquote, better people, more loving, more caring?
So one
and
of
so
the
that,
tests
that was
you,
my criteria.
Well, one of the signs that. For you was going to be yeah. It worked if your depression lifted.
Yes.
And in fact, through some periods of this journey, it seems as if the depression got worse. But before I ask you about that, tell me, before we move on from the first religion you explored, Sufism, what you determined Sufism was about.
the Sufis have this notion of the heart. And by the heart, they don't mean, obviously, this thing pumping in our chest, but nor do they mean the sort of kind of schmaltzy Hallmark heart either. They believe that the heart is basically almost like an organ of perception. It's our intuitive, you know, GPS, internal GPS about guiding our way through life. Only the problem is our heart is all clogged up and it's covered with dust and it needs to be polished. In fact, they talk about the need to polish the heart quite a lot. And so essentially Sufism is about polishing the heart, about doing these exercises so that we can get in touch with this internal GPS of the soul that allows us to make better decisions and to do what's not only in our interest but in the interest of loved ones. And to stop banging our head against the wall. And that by doing these practices, by getting quiet or sometimes getting musical or doing various things, we can polish the heart and steer a bit more sanely through the world.
My sense from what you write in the book, Man Seeks God, is that you left Turkey feeling greater respect for Sufism, but also knowing it was not for you.
I did feel great respect for it, and I felt here's a part of Islam that I knew little about, and that to me is actually a wonderful religion, if I can call Sufism a wonderful religion. But it is tied up with Islam, more than tied up with Islam. It is basically a part of Islam, and that raises issues in today's world. And I don't know if I could, you know, fully convert to Islam. I know my parents wouldn't be too happy, that's for sure. But it would be problematic.
But the phrase "there is no God but God," you pick up here, and it stays with you throughout the journey.
It does.
And next
La ilaha illallah in Arabic, yes.
I'm sorry, I interrupted. Please.
In Arabic, it's la ilaha illallah. It's very melodic, and it's very almost hypnotizing if you repeat it as Sufis do over and over again. And I always had a problem with that phrase because I always thought there's no God but our God, and it struck me as exclusionary. But the way Sufis explained it to me, that phrase, there is no God but God, is one way of interpreting it is there is nothing but God. There is nothing around us in the world that is not part of God, in quotes, if you can put God in quotes. Can you put God in quotes? I'm not sure. I just did. Okay. So it's almost a pantheistic view that there, you know, there's nothing that is unholy. And that's a very different interpretation of that phrase. And this happened to me constantly, Tom, that, you know, sort of especially with religions like Islam and Christianity, where I thought I knew what it was, I met people, wonderful people, who told me, no, it's actually not what you think it is. It's better than that.
Well, we have seven other religions that you've covered in your book. I don't know that we're going to be able to get to all of them, but we've got to at least talk about the giant marshmallow in India, the experience with Wayne of New Jersey, and certainly the time where you had to shave your legs and become a woman for a few hours. So we're going to get into all that and touch as much as we can on as many of the religions you touch upon as possible when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. The root of the problem, I think, is my fear of death. My friends say it is irrational. They are wrong. My fear of death is entirely rational. I will die. That is a fact. That I don't know precisely when or how affords small consolation. Simply put, the thought of not existing freaks me out. I don't know how people get out of bed in the morning knowing that each day brings us 24 hours closer to non-existence. From the book Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine, by Eric Weiner, former NPR correspondent, good chance you listening recognize his name because he spent so many years with NPR before he started going around the world writing books. If you want to talk to him, we have some phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. Or you can post on our Facebook page where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Eric Weiner, how much did fear of death play a role in your depression?
That is a good question. I don't know. I think fear of death might play a role in anxiety, perhaps more than depression. But, you know, it is probably even more than religion or God. It's the one subject that we really don't talk about in this country, and that is death. Death is something that happens behind closed doors. We don't talk about it with friends or family very much, yet we're all going to die. We know that. And I think it is the root cause for this sort of low background hum of anxiety that I think everyone in this country suffers from on some level. I could be wrong. Maybe there are people who don't fear death and have sort of transcended that.
Were you searching for a religion that would tell you whether or not there is life or death or convince you one way or another?
No, absolutely not. I was not, I think all religions do attempt to answer what I call the big three questions. You know, where do we come from? Where do we go after we die? And how should we live our lives in the meantime? And it was really that third question that I was most interested in. I don't think there is a religion out there that can convince me of the answer to, say, the second question, what happens when we die. And I think, at least for me, I don't want to speak for other people, but for me, that is not what I'm looking for in a religion, is an answer to that question. I'm interested in religion, again, as a sort of applied philosophy, because I believe science is wonderful, and I'm a huge fan and proponent of science, but I don't believe science helps us get through the day when we're suffering from anxiety or depression or a myriad of other problems. You know, philosophers used to play that role. You know, back in the time of ancient Greeks, philosophers were rock stars, you know. They were the Oprah of the day, and people listened to them. And they were not just academics who wrote papers that nobody read. So we've lost the philosopher as a sort of guide in the world. And to me, that leaves religion as the best available source out there for some sort of wisdom about how to live our lives.
I realize we're running short on time, so let me skip through some of the rest of what appears in your book, including India, Buddhism, the giant marshmallow.
Nepal, actually, but yes, it was in Kathmandu. The giant marshmallow was my name for a giant stupa. It looked like a giant marshmallow to me in this place called Bodhanath, just on the outskirts of Kathmandu in Nepal. And it's a wonderful place. It is a shrine to Buddha in a way, but it is not like any shrine I've seen before because it was a living shrine. Life, a whole village had cropped up around the stupa. So there were shops selling things. There were restaurants. There were cafes. You could sip a very good Zinfandel while staring at this shrine and watching Buddhists, tourists alike, and myself circling it clockwise, always clockwise, round and round and round and round. And it was wonderfully alive.
In addition to Sufism and Buddhism and Wicca, which was mentioned, you also went into one particular aspect of Christianity, spending time in the South Bronx with Franciscan friars. You spent time in China studying the Tao. The weirdest religion, I would think, I don't know if you characterize it this way, Eric Weiner, had to be, from my view, the time you spent in Las Vegas. Were they called the Raelians?
The Raelians, yes. Well, anything that involves Vegas has got to be a little bit off center, right? Right off the bat. Yes, they're called the Raelians. Let's just be honest here. It was the strangest religion I explored.
And some people might think of them as a cult, but you did not, because they didn't meet your criteria of being coercive. In fact, you thought they were a very happy group. It's just their basic philosophy that they were that human beings were planted on Earth about 25,000 years ago by species from another planet, and those are sort of our overlords. And this guy, I guess his name is Rael or something?
Rael, yes, founder.
He's their prophet. And basically their religion is about having a good time?
Absolutely. It's all about the fun and the pleasure, I would say. There are a lot of former Catholics who are members of the Raelians. In fact, that must make up the vast majority of their membership. In a way, it strikes me as very much a reaction to the restrictions on pleasure in Catholicism.
And there were tens of thousands of people who were actually part of this religion?
They claim to have some 80,000 members in 100 countries, which is an impressive figure. But if you attend one of their sessions, as I did, a week-long session in Vegas, you would have to think, well, why don't they have more members? I mean, they are advocating sex on a fairly significant scale, I would say, and pleasure, and not drugs. And not caffeine, too. There was no coffee served at the Raelian Convention, and I'm a huge coffee head, and that was a problem for me.
That's very clear several times in your book, but I gotta believe the hardest part of your experience with the Raelians, Eric Weiner, was shaving your legs. Because how you describe it, it sounds like it got really bloody.
It was not pretty. Well, they had... I was there somewhat undercover, I would say, and I wanted to participate fully in everything they did. I mean, that was the basis of my book was, you know, don't just observe, don't be a journalist, be a participant. So when it came time for the gender awareness workshop, I was like, I've got to do this. And the gender awareness workshop was the boys become girls, girls become boys, at least dress up that way. And then they interact. So you can see what it's like to be wearing the other shoe, I suppose. And so that entailed shaving my legs, which, have you ever shaved your legs? You see, I'm putting you on the spot now.
I'm trying to think. I actually have shaved different parts of my body for when I was much more of an athlete.
Okay.
But no, not my legs. I can never remember shaving my legs.
I don't know how women do it. I mean, I don't know why you would do it more than once. Let's put it that way. It's like, it is painful. It was a bloody mess. I was given a dress and I, you know, had to.
But you felt you learned something about seeing the world from a more female point of view.
I did. I mean, I found it odd and silly as well. But I did understand that it's difficult to walk in heels, first of all. I mean, like, why would you do that? And it's just stuff to keep together, and my breasts were these, you know, wadded up toilet paper, and they kept migrating to like my kidney area, and I had to keep putting them back, and it was but you know, I want to say before listeners think that this was just some farce that I was on, that even with the Raelians, you know, I was looking for at least object lessons about the religious life, and I conclude the Raelians are not for me. But that's odd because I like to have fun. So why would I not want a religion that's all about fun? Why would anybody, you know, why don't the Raelians have millions and millions and hundreds of millions of members worldwide? And I conclude that basically it's because it's too easy. We don't want a religion that's about fun. You know, we want religion to be hard. We want it to be challenging. We want it to raise our eyes, not to lower them. And I think ultimately, well, there are a number of reasons, but that's one reason why the Raelians don't have a broader membership, is that it's all about fun. And we've got Disney World for that. We don't need a religion that's about fun.
Eric Weiner is best known, of course, for his almost 20 years of work as a correspondent for NPR, reporting from New Delhi, Tokyo, and Jerusalem. But he's also written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, and a host of other high-profile publications. His most recent book-length publication is our focus this hour. It is titled Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. You may also recall his previous book, which was titled The Geography of Bliss. So we've only got a couple of minutes left. Let's jump to the end. You go back to what for you is sort of the homeland. You go to Israel to study a very specific branch of Judaism.
Mm-hmm. Kabbalah. And I imagine if you're like most people, when I asked about Kabbalah and what they knew about it, I received a one-word reply. Do you know
and
what that
actually,
word?
No. Again, I guess I'm weird.
Yeah.
Maybe because I've been fascinated by world religions for a long time, but the phrase that comes to mind when I hear that word is mysticism. Other
Good.
People,
not Madonna. Madonna
yes, other people use another M word, Madonna.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And mysticism is the right word. It is the mystical arm of Judaism, somewhat controversial as all mystical paths are. And I went to Israel, not to L.A., which maybe would be the more obvious place in some respects. And I was surprised by what I found. I found a Judaism of the heart. Judaism's missing heart is the way I put it, I believe. I quite enjoyed my time there and felt that, wow, here, that for instance, there's a Jewish tradition of meditation. I had no idea. Or that there is a Jewish tradition of approaching the world from a very heart-centric point of view. It's not all about study and furrowing your brow and putting in the hours with the Talmud. It's about much more than that. And
Eric,
I got a really
clear sense from reading this book, which is just such a pleasure in so many ways, that part of what would resonate for you in a religion that works is something that added a sense of real meaning to life. And somewhere in the middle of the book, I think, I don't remember exactly who you're quoting. It might have been William James, but you quote somebody who says, for most of us, it is extremely difficult to escape the influences of religion that we were exposed to as young children. Mm-hmm. So if I've got that about right, does it make sense to you that if you're searching for meaning, that when you look deeply into the religion that you were exposed to as a child, that's where you're going to find it?
Yeah, and that was Joseph Campbell, who had a lot of wonderful things to say on this subject. And yeah, his argument was, you know, to some extent we have to grow where we're planted. And you know, this is the advice the Dalai Lama often gives people of various faiths who come to him and say, I want to be Buddhist. He says, no, you know, remain Jewish or Christian or whatever faith you were born into. You can meditate, you can take on certain Buddhist tenets, but, you know, grow where you were planted. And for me, the challenge ultimately was finding the music in Judaism that I found lacking up until this point. And I think that, you know, I think sometimes we can find a spiritual home outside of where we were born into. But oftentimes, and because I met so many people in my travels researching this book, I met so many people who made a round-trip journey, who started off, say, as Jewish, dabbled in Buddhism and Hinduism, found some meaning there, but ultimately circled back to their own faith, where they started off. And that seems okay. That seems more than okay, actually.
So here's a question that I wish we could have had a whole hour to discuss, but now that we've got a tad more than a minute left, I'll just toss it in.
Mm.
How are you different now than you were before you started this journey?
Whew, that might take more than a minute. You're right. I would say briefly that if I were to answer that nurse's question, if I can take your question and twist it a bit, if I were to go back to her and ask, have you found your God yet? I would have to honestly say no, not yet. But I don't know if the question is right. You know, God is not a destination where we just find it and then we're done. An Austrian poet, Rainer Maria Rilke, once said that God is a direction. And I quite like that. And I would say that I am heading in a direction, a more spiritual direction than I was before writing this book. I also have picked up little bits and pieces of wisdom, applied philosophy on the road. I don't actually say grace all the time before I eat, but I will often pause before eating and contemplate the amazing fact that there is food in front of me. before just devouring it and inhaling it. And there are other small things, but small things add up about navigating life that I picked up during my travels. And I'm also, to be honest, more Jewish than I was before. I have found something in my own faith that I think is a foundation I can build upon, but that's not going to stop me from meditating like a Buddhist or whirling like a dervish as well. I think it's all possible.
Those people that I imagine you still run into who kind of look down their nose when anybody admits to being interested in God or believing in religion, do you find it easier to talk to such people these days?
Yeah, I find that I'm less defensive, and to some extent, you know, I let them go their way and I go my way. But I think, you know, we're all looking for a meaningful life. We're all looking for a life that is truly lived and experienced as deeply as possible. So I don't think the conflict between the secular and religious is as great as it often appears.
Our guest has been Eric Weiner. He's been speaking to us from a studio we rented out today in Washington, D.C. We're thinking it was a place reasonably familiar to him since it belongs to NPR, where he used to work. Mr. Weiner's newest book is titled Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Eric, it's been such a delight. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed this.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about our guest. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.